Today, the noose is tightening. The DFA Daily for the 1st of May 2020. Hello again, I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Welcome to our latest post covering finance and prop news with a distinctively Australian flavour. As the tide recedes, the wreckage is becoming ever more obvious. The latest ABS household impacts of the COVID-19 survey out today shows that nearly half, around 45%, of Australians aged 18 years and over had their household finances impacted by the virus in the period mid-March to mid-April. And one third of Australians, or 31%, reported that their household finances had worsened over this period, while one in seven, or 14%, reported an improvement. While the majority of Australians, at 81%, said their household could raise $2,000 for something important within a week, lower than the 84% back in 2014, a smaller number of Australians reported experiencing financial hardship. One in 13 Australians, or 7.5%, said their households lacked the money to pay one or more bills on time. And one in 10% had to draw on accumulated savings to support basic living expenses. A quarter of Australians aged 18 years and over, or 28%, said they received the first one-off $750 economic support payment announced by the Commonwealth Government in March as part of the economic stimulus package. Those aged 65 years and over were more likely than those aged 18 to 64 to have received the first one-off economic support payment, which is 60% compared with 19%. Around half, or 53%, of persons who received the economic support payment added it to savings, with persons aged 65 years and over more likely to do so than persons aged 18 to 64, 71% compared with 37%. And the survey also collected information about Australians' emotional and mental well-being over the period mid-March to mid-April, and compared the results with those from the ABS 2017-18 National Health Survey. Compared to the earlier survey, almost twice as many adults reported feelings associated with anxiety, such as nervousness or restlessness, at least some of the time over the past 4 weeks. Adults aged 18 to 64 were nearly twice as likely as those aged 65 years and over to experience feelings relating to anxiety, at least some of the time. With limitations on movements associated with the virus restrictions, fewer Australians were seeing friends and family outside the home compared to the results of the general 2014 social survey, 48% compared to 76% in 2014. But many were using alternative ways to stay in touch while in lockdown during the first 2 weeks of April. Two-thirds of Australians, or 65%, increased their frequency of non-face-to-face contact with family and friends outside of their household, most commonly via audio-only calls at 92%, text and instant messaging 86%, and video calls at 67%. And the Australian Industry Group Australian Performance of Manufacturing Index, the PMI, dropped by 17.9 points to 35.8 points in April. This indicates that Australian manufacturing contracted at its worst pace since April 2009. It is the largest month-on-month fall in the history of the index. Results below 50 point to contractions, with lower results indicating a faster rate of contraction. The sharp spike in positive conditions in March was more than completely reversed in April, as the unusual surge in demand for manufactured food and groceries subsided. Manufacturers cited a range of COVID-related issues in April, with the most prevailing including no new sales due to shutdowns, major customers cancelling orders, supply chain problems with interstate freight movements and delays, and increased prices of raw materials. All activity indices plunged in April, with activity levels now reminiscent of the global financial crisis plunge in 2009. The chemical section was the only manufacturing sector to improve in April, with continuing strong demand for personal care items such as hand sanitizers, pharmaceuticals, cleaning products, toiletries, and health supplements, much of which is made locally. The food and beverages sector continued to report positive conditions in April, results above 50, due to strong local demand, but at a slower pace than in March, as stockpiling subsided. Private sector wages across the manufacturing industry rose by an average of 0.4% over the quarter and 1.8% per annum to the fourth quarter 2019, according to the ABS Wage Price Index. The Australian PMI average wage index decreased by 8.4 points to 49.5 points. This indicates manufacturing wages were broadly stable on average in April, and this was the lowest monthly result in the history of the series since September 2007, and only the second time it's fallen below 50 points and indicating a contraction. This low result indicates that few, if any, manufacturers were able to increase their employees' average wages in April. And there were 921,200 filled jobs in manufacturing in the fourth quarter 2019, which was 7.2% of all filled jobs in Australia, according to the ABS Labour Account. The number of filled jobs in manufacturing increased by 1.1% quarter over quarter and 4.5% per annum in the fourth quarter 2019. The more volatile ABS labour force survey identified 923,300 people working in manufacturing in February 2020, up 1.4% over the quarter and 4.2% over the year. The Australian PMI Employment Index plummeted 21.7 points in April, indicating a steep contraction in manufacturing employment as many businesses stand down staff, reduce staff numbers, or reduce their work hours because of the virus restrictions. This is the largest monthly fall in the history of this data series and its lowest level since April 2009. The employment index contracted for all sectors in April. But according to the CoreLogic Home Value Index, out today, Australian housing values have not seen any evidence of a material decline in April, despite a sharp drop in market activity and a severe weakening in consumer sentiment. Although most regions recorded a rise in home values through April, the monthly pace of growth more than halved, dropping from 0.7% in March to 0.3%. The April result was the smallest month-on-month movement since June last year, when the national index was down 0.2%. CoreLogic Head of Research Tim Lawless said, although housing values were generally slightly positive over the month, the trend was clearly weakening since the mid to late March, when social distancing policies were implemented and consumer sentiment started to plummet. The capital city markets generally showed a weaker performance relative to the regional markets, with the combined capital cities index up 0.2% in April compared to 0.5% across the combined regional markets. The sharpest reversal in growth conditions can be seen in Melbourne, where values nudged into negative territory through April, down 0.3%. Sydney values remained positive, rising 0.4% over the month. To provide some context, the 6 months prior to March saw both cities averaging a monthly growth rate around 1.7%. According to Mr. Lawless, Australia's largest cities have a higher level of downside risk. Sydney and Melbourne arguably show a higher risk profile relative to other markets due to their large exposure to overseas migration as a source of housing demand, along with greater exposure to the downturn in foreign students, stretched housing affordability, and already low rental yields that are likely to reduce further on the back of rising vacancy rates and lower rents. Hobart was the only other major region to record a decline in home values over the month, down 0.1%. Explaining the drop in Hobart values, Mr. Lawless said Hobart has the most exposure of any capital city, at least proportionally, to the industry sectors most heavily impacted by COVID-19 in terms of employment, with 12.7% of the workforce employed within accommodation and food services and arts and recreation service sectors. Despite the weakening in home market conditions, some cities have outperformed the six-month average pace of change, with Perth up 0.2%, Adelaide up 0.4%, and Darwin up 1.7%, and they outperformed their six-month average pace of growth in April, demonstrating, he said, some resilience to weaker conditions. I suppose it's all relative. Over in the US, millions more Americans filed for unemployment benefits last week, sending the six-week total above 30 million since the virus pandemic began to shutter businesses across the country. Initial jobless claims totaled 3.84 million in the week ended 25th of April, following 4.4 million in the prior week, according to Labor Department figures. Economists had projected 3.5 million claims. While filings remain at levels unseen before the crisis, it's the fourth week that the pace has deaccelerated, suggesting that the worst of the labour market hit may have already occurred. At the same time, job losses remain far from over, and employment is expected to take years to eventually recover. Plus, more layoffs could be in store as states and municipalities face severe budget crunches. The number of claims, assuming each person is counted as unemployed, could imply a jobless rate of around 22%, which would be the highest since the Great Depression in the 1930s. And that's also far above the peak of 10% reached in 2009 in the wake of the last recession. Florida, whose governor plans to start reopening the state on Monday, had the most claims last week, with an estimated 432,500 on an unadjusted basis. That was followed by California at 328,000 and Georgia at 264,800. Most states reported declines. The latest figures offer a sobering preview of the government's April jobs report due next Friday, which is expected to show a 22 million decline in payrolls and a jobless rate of 16.3%. Those figures will reflect the period from mid-March through to mid-April, when efforts to contain the spread of the virus went into full swing, causing countless layoffs in restaurants, retailers, and other businesses. Continuing claims, or the total number of Americans receiving unemployment benefits, rose by 2.17 million to a record 18 million in the week ended April the 18th. That sent the insured unemployment rate, which measures the unemployed receiving benefits as a share of the labour market, to a record 12.4% compared to 1.2% before the crisis. The ongoing demand for unemployment benefits signals that the recession will be difficult to bounce back from. Figures on Wednesday showed gross domestic product contracted in the first quarter by the most since 2008, and the second quarter is widely forecast as a historic decline. Less employment means less consumer spending. That's the largest part of the economy. And more weakness ahead as the drop in demand spreads to other industries. Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell encouraged the government to provide more stimulus to support the economy in remarks he made on Wednesday. He also highlighted that the burdens are falling most heavily on those least able to carry them. The downturn's depth and duration are extremely uncertain and will depend on control of the virus, as well as government aid, he said. State unemployment agencies have struggled to cope with the unprecedented surge in applications since March, and there have been many delays in processing and accounting for the magnitude of the job losses. Some states have staggered applications by name on different days, while others have been working through a backlog. And separate data on Thursday showed household spending, which accounts for about two-thirds of the economy, plunged 7.5% in March from the prior month, and that's the sharpest drop in Commerce Department records right the way back to 1959. And also, the Federal Reserve on Thursday expanded access to its Paycheck Protection Program Liquidity Facility, the PPPLF, to additional lenders and expanded the collateral that can be pledged. The changes will facilitate lending to small businesses via the Small Business Administration's Paycheck Protection Program, the PPP. As a result of the changes, all PPP lenders approved by the SBA, including non-depository institutional lenders, are now eligible to participate in the PPPLF. SBA qualified PPP lenders include banks, credit unions, community development financial institutions, members of the farm credit system, small business lending companies licensed by the SBA, and some financial technology firms. When the PPPLF was announced, the Federal Reserve said the facility would immediately lend to depository institutions and that non-depository institutions would be added as soon as possible. Additionally, eligible borrowers will be able to pledge whole PPP loans that they've purchased as collateral to the PPPLF. An institution that pledges a purchased PPP loan will need to provide the Reserve Bank with documentation from the SBA demonstrating that the pledging institution is the beneficiary of the SBA guarantee for the loan. The SBA's PPP guarantees loans from qualified lenders to small businesses so that those businesses can keep workers employed, and the PPPLF supports the PPP by extending credit to financial institutions that make or purchase PPP loans using the loans as collateral. The additional liquidity from the PPPLF increases the capacity of financial institutions to make additional PPP loans. But just to be clear, the Fed is essentially helping the banks lend, but the banks still have to make those loans and are still charging businesses for the privilege. And over in Europe, figures earlier today show that the euro area output shrank the most on record during the first quarter, a period only partially blighted by the lockdowns. Countries such as Italy, Spain and France, with limited room to spend their way out of the crisis, saw contractions of around 5%. The EU's response to the meltdown contrasts with other major economies where fiscal support has been stronger. Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell warned on Wednesday, after maintaining his institution's own emergency settings, that this is not the time to worry about the US debt burden. When we compare what we're seeing out in the Fed and US policymakers more broadly, the scale in response is much different. Michael Powell, Global Chief Investment Strategist of BlackRock, told Bloomberg Television, "We're going to need to see quite a bit more looking ahead." But while the European Central Bank has stepped up its responses to the coronavirus crisis by cutting funding costs for banks, it's refrained from boosting its bond buying program and renewed its call on politicians to provide more fiscal support. Just hours after data showed the worst contraction over 3 months in a quarter of a century of statistics, President Christine Lagarde warned that the euro area economy could shrink as much as 15% in the second quarter and 12% over the full year. The magnitude of the shock demands an ambitious and coordinated fiscal response, she said in a virtual press conference on Thursday. Finance ministers should have a joint approach and show solidarity to those most affected by the crisis. Her comments reflect the European Union's struggle to come up with a unified response so far. Most government action has been at the national level. Leaders have asked the European Commission to devise a broader proposal by May the 6th, although it's unclear how to resolve disagreements on whether aid should take the form of grants or loans. Likewise, Germany and the Netherlands have led opposition to joint debt over fears they'll end up with much of the bill. The squabbling has unnerved investors who fret that heavily indebted nations such as Italy will be tipped into a deeper crisis. The country's credit rating was unexpectedly cut by Fitch this week. Italian bond yields initially rose when the ECB announced that it would keep its pandemic bond buying program unchanged at 750 billion euros. They then fluctuated as investors digested the central bank's other actions, which includes de facto interest rate cuts for its loans to banks. The lowest rate on the targeted program that gives banks incentives to lend to companies and households will fall to 50 basis points below the deposit rate, meaning that they will be able to borrow for minus 1%. The cost of a new non-targeted facility will be minus 0.25%. For today, it's enough, says Carsten Brzeski, an economist at ING in Frankfurt. So much has been announced in the past 6 weeks. Together with earlier programmes, the ECB has pledged to buy more than €1 trillion of debt through to the end of this year. And most economists predict the policymakers will eventually bump up the emergency programme, which can be targeted towards stressed economies. Lagarde did signal that that was an option. The central bank is fully prepared to increase the programme if needed, she said, depending on the length of the crisis. It might be extended further than the end of 2020. Lockdowns to curb the spread of the coronavirus have sent unemployment soaring across the region and burdened the economies with massive costs. The Governing Council is fully prepared to increase the size of the PEPP and adjust its composition by as much as necessary and for as long as is needed. In any case, it stands ready to adjust all of its instruments as appropriate to ensure that inflation moves towards its aim in a sustained manner, in line with its commitments to symmetry. So they are going to do anything, and yet they can't agree on how they're going to create those bonds and who's going to be bailed out. I think the euro still is in a bit of a mess. And finally, all of this has consequences as Deutsche Bank introduced negative interest rates for deposits over €100,000. The regulation will only apply to new contracts and concerns current and overnight accounts. Negative interest rates on private customer deposits are emerging in an increasing number of banks, as Yasmin Osman reported from Frankfurt. Deutsche Bank will soon introduce negative interest rates for large deposits on its retail banking business and that of its subsidiary Postbank. The ongoing pressure from negative interest rates makes it necessary for Deutsche Bank to charge custody fees for new contracts for high deposits beyond an allowance of €100,000 per account from May 18, 2020, a spokesman for the bank told Handelsblatt. The custody fee should amount to 0.5% and thus corresponds to the fees that the European Central Bank charges banks for money parked there. This helps us on the earnings side, but above all, it helps to prevent further inflows of particularly high deposits that cost us money, wrote Manfred Koff, head of the bank's German private customer business, to his employees. This applies especially in the event that other banks further adjust their conditions and their customers are looking for an alternative for their deposits with us. So far, Deutsche Bank has only charged large corporate clients and very wealthy private clients negative interest rates on deposits. The new regulation for high private customer deposits of more than €100,000 applies exclusively for new contracts in the private customer business. Existing account contracts are not affected, said a spokesman for the bank. Customers with lower deposits are also spared. In the broader customer business with relatively low deposits, Deutsche Bank does not pass on custody fees to customers for deposits. But Deutsche Bank is not the first institution to charge negative interest rates for large retail deposits. They pass on the penalty interest that the ECB in turn demands from credit institutions. While this price policy in Germany initially only affected corporate customers, the strategy is now also making an impact on larger retail deposits. As early as September 2019, around a quarter of all sight deposits by private customers were affected by negative interest rates, according to the Bundesbank's November's monthly report. Since then, the number of banks that have introduced such charges has continued to increase. The negative interest rates affect current and call money accounts, as well as certain investment accounts. New contracts for savings accounts, such as Deutsche Bank's fixed interest savings or Sparkart accounts, however, are not affected until further notice. And in its quarterly outlook, the bank announced that it was planning to take advantage of price adjustment opportunities in Germany. That was probably due to the negative interest rates. Low interest rates have a noticeable impact on the institute. The bank was only able to increase its income in the private customer area, in the commission area, and interest income shrank despite the growth in the lending business. This particularly affects the German division. After all, only wealth management and international businesses achieved earnings growth in the first quarter. The bank had originally hoped to expand in Germany this year. The Institute now only expects stable earnings. The planned earnings growth in the investment and lending business is likely to be consumed by the negative effects of the low interest rate environment and the COVID-19 pandemic, says the quarterly report. But the trouble is, as night follows day, ever lower central bank rates leads to negative rates, which leads to charges on deposits. So those who last year accused us of being doom merchants better wake up, as it's happening before our very eyes. And down the track, I see no reason why Australia will not eventually go the same way. It may take a bit of time, but we do seem to be on the same trajectory. I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Many thanks for watching, and I'll see you again next time.